Friday, I'm in Love by Chai Chak, read by Cookie Mom 6067. The state of Jim Kirk's communicator is a shorthand on the Farragut for his management style, and it is safe to say that he is proud of this. The Type 2 communicator is still part of standard operating kit for deep space exploration, and this specific one has been at Jim's side since he'd first come onto the Farragut as a newly minted Lieutenant JG, starry-eyed and wet behind the ears. For 8 years, he had taken it on every away mission and every shore leave and brought it back without fail. That is not that there had not been any close calls. He'd almost lost it on an away mission just a few weeks ago, and the pang of worry when he realized it had fallen out of a torn pocket was as gutting as the reason why it has its distinctive dent in the casing. No matter how much the captain complained that it breached uniform standard, Jim kept it, and the crew of the Farragut kept the dented communicator in their hearts as a sign that everything is well, as if that dent could save all their lives the way it had saved Jim's from his probably fated death at the end of a hostile lizard's horn back in 56. That doesn't mean that Jim doesn't have another one for special occasions. And that is that one he took on shore leave. And even though it uses the same accounts, connects to the same network, even likely came out of the same Starfleet Central fabricator, Jim swears that it just isn't as good as that old battered hunk of trite. Carol looks blurry on the small screen, and he holds the defective communicator up to the window in an echo of an ancient ritual to ensure a good connection. Jim, she says, and she sounds exhausted. The subspace delay is just a bit too long for her mouth and voice to match up properly. Jim, I have to tell you something. It's about the baby. They're monitoring us, but I just wanted you to know that things aren't going well. The connection is bad, so I'll call you again later. Just keep your communicator on. The Farragut is officially one of the Enterprise's sister ships, which should mean that life on board follows the same patterns, for better or worse. But Spock wakes up in his guest quarters, aware that he is facing the wrong way, and with a curious knot in his stomach. Rolling over, he finds himself alone, which shouldn't be a surprise. But it's amazing how quickly you can get used to something good. The other side of the bed is as meticulously well made as any drill sergeant or Vulcan mother could desire. Jim went on duty almost as soon as they'd got back, and Spock had got lost in his messages upon reconnecting his pad to the comm network. And by the time he had finished proofing 10 reports, correcting a frankly egregious error in some code that Sam Kirk should have caught weeks ago, and catching up on a weekend of internal communications on various Enterprise group chats, it was time for dinner. Captain Reuben had invited him to dine with him as he showed him to his quarters, but had warned him that it would be replicator fare, not anything special. But by the time Spock was washing his face in the small ensuite bathroom, Reuben had canceled, citing something you'll no doubt hear about in the fullness of time. Instead, Spock politely asks the computer for directions to the officer's mess, and then takes himself there, doubling back to get a book. Officers' guest quarters are often excellent sources of abandoned literature, and there is the latest in the Bio-Bedlam series of schlocky medical mysteries, and to his great luck, it was even the Vulcan version. There is a belief among the fleet that Vulcan versions of so-called trashy literature are produced entirely for the export market for the educated to hide that they're reading something so base as a thriller or erotic novel. Spock is definitely hidden behind this in the past, even if he knows that it is not entirely true. The officer's mess is a deck up and relatively busy for the time of night. He orders the vegetarian special, which turns out to be an amorphous green sludge with perfectly square block of sticky rice, which the computer insists is a vegan Thai green curry with fragrant jasmine rice. Spock learned young that arguing with computers is the first sign of madness, and so suppresses his desire to force it to consider a logical fallacy so brutal it would deep fry the next 3 meals to come out of it, and instead takes a seat in the corner. He pauses and then opens his pad and sends Jim a message. "Spock, the Farragut's replicators are even worse than you indicated." The indicator of delivered and read appears in the corner, but there is no reply, and so Spock puts down the pad and forces himself to eat the latest insult to the good people of Thailand that Starfleet's culinary engineers had formulated, and cracks the spine of BioBedlam 4 transporter malfunction with relish. He is thoroughly enjoying the protagonist's investigation into a series of people who return to the ship with their white blood cells depleted when he is interrupted by a discreet cough. "Can I join you?" a woman asks as Spock looks up and hastily snaps the book closed, placing it face down on the table, and gestures to the seat opposite. The woman, a commander by her stripes, sits down and surprises him by extending a flawless to all. "I am Commander Petra Adelaide, head of operations," she says in Vulcan. "I am honored to meet you. Our mutual friend James has told me much about you." Spock swallows and reciprocates. "Honored to make your acquaintance," he says, sliding the book off the table discreetly. "Your Vulcan is exceptional." "Thank you," she smiles, and digs into something on her plate that seems similarly amorphous, just brown and pink rather than green. "I apologize on behalf of the Farragut for the state of the replicator. There was an update, and Jim has yet to do his magic on it." Spock raises an eyebrow. "I did not realize Commander Kirk was a skilled replicator engineer," he says. "How long have you served together?" Adelaide shrugs. "Ever since the war, so, 3 years?" Vulcan is not a language that lends itself to the ums and ahs of human speech, so she drops into standard cadence for that and doesn't pick it up again. "Wow, I hadn't realized it had been 3 years. Sorry, I can't do emotional language in Vulcan. I wouldn't know where to start." "Understandable," Spock replies in standard. Adelaide drops her voice. "I was on the Shenzhou at the binaries," she says, and smiles at him sadly. "I knew Michael. I'm so sorry." She switches back into Vulcan. "I grieve with thee." Spock swallows around a lump in the back of his throat. "Thank you," he says in Vulcan. "I grieve with thee. We all lost a lot of people in the war." Commander Adelaide goes to say something else, but then they are interrupted by Jim. "Am I interrupting something?" he asks, holding his own tray, and kicks over a chair from another table to join theirs. "Jimmy," Commander Adelaide says, inclining her head at Spock, "I was just interrogating your young man." "Regular or enhanced?" Jim asks, sitting down, and Spock can tell he's nervous. "Oh, that would be telling," Petra says, slyly. Spock is as closed as the book he's hiding under the table. "Commander Adelaide is being generous. In fact, I cracked almost immediately," Spock interjects. "Apologies, Jim. Your secrets are no longer safe with me. I have failed you." Humor is the refuge of the damned, and a card Spock rarely plays. But the previous conversation was not one he wanted to return to, and he also had no desire to talk about the book, especially as he had only just started it. Commander Adelaide laughs and elbows Jim in the side. "You said he was funny and I didn't believe you." "Why do I do that? Anyway, I like him more than Starbase One, so good going, Mr. Kirk. Keep it up. Might make a respectable officer out of you yet." Jim goes red and crams a piece of broccoli into his mouth before shutting his eyes and shaking his head. "Petra," he mumbles, keeping his mouth as closed as he can. "Cough." And Commander Adelaide laughs, ruffles his hair, shoots Spock the T'all again with a wink, and walks off. "Sorry I didn't reply earlier," Jim says. "Came back from 3 days' leave to half the ship not talking to the other half, the captain in a flap, and more paperwork that seems possible to ever catch up on." "I understand," Spock says. "My own inbox was unwieldy." "How's it looking now?" Jim says slyly. He looks up at the chronometer on the wall over Spock's head. "I get off in 4 hours. I could swing by, test out my command override, if you get my meaning." He waggles his eyebrows suggestively. You have been away from the ship for several days. They might have stopped working. You will have to test them to find out, Spock says, thrilling at the idea of Jim stealing into his quarters and waking him up with a kiss and the long, hard line of his body, and takes the last bite of his sludge before lining up his utensils and standing up. I will be there. Please do not be square, he says, and leaves to the sound of Jim's shocked laughter with a sense of triumphant relief, the book tucked carefully in the pocket of his trousers. The book turns out to be a great distraction for the rest of the evening, and Spock falls asleep satisfied with the denouement of the plot and anticipating great satisfaction once Jim comes to ravish him. But when he wakes up in the morning, his bed is cold and his door as locked as he had left it, and all he has left is a sinking feeling in his chest. A full beta shift is an uncomfortable thing at the best of times. But with the dual swords of Carol's message and Spock's everything hanging over him, Jim is doubly exhausted by the time he returns to his quarters. He throws himself down onto the bed and groans long and low before sitting up and checking his communicator for any messages. Figuring there is nothing he can do about Carol but wait, Jim goes into the bathroom to prepare for making it up to Spock. He looks very excited at the thought of Jim violating the correct use of command overrides earlier, and even though Jim is exhausted, he's never too exhausted to not want to curl up in bed with Spock and let himself be vigorously fucked to a mind-shattering orgasm. He's on beta all week, so he can even sleep in if he wants, maybe have another go in the morning. Maybe Spock will let him reenact some of the greatest hits of their holiday. He changes into something more comfortable, and that he doesn't mind getting ripped off his body, and wanders back into his room just in time to catch the communicator before it buzzes itself off the bed and onto the floor. He flips it open. Carol? Jim. Carol's voice echoes on the line, but despite that, Jim can hear the emotion thickening her accent like she'd been home for a month. She's been crying. And not a bit. These are the kind of tears he's only seen her cry once before. She sniffs, wiping her nose on her sleeve, and then dissolves into tears again. Jim, there's something wrong with him, she says, as tears stream down her face. They're inducing me tomorrow. They're giving him as much time as possible in the womb for the drugs to work on his lungs, but he's going to be so tiny, too tiny. Can you be here? How long can you give me? He asks. Because Sam was right. Something is happening in his chest, something he had half hoped wouldn't happen, that he'd be proven right. But he has to try. He has to give this a chance. Love bubbles out of him from a well thought dry. Carol, how long? How long? 36 hours, she sniffs. Maybe. It depends. They've got a plan. I can send it to you. Maybe you can have someone look it over. Your friend Leonard? I'm sorry, I'm just so scared. No, of course, send it over. I need to talk to Len tomorrow. He'll be asleep now, but I'll talk to the captain now. Carol, listen, I'm going to do everything I can to be there, I promise. I'm going to go talk to the captain now. Hold on. Carol nods with a mumbled thanks and ends the call. And then a few moments later, a document pings into his inbox. He checks it, but his mind is racing too much for him to even try and work out what it says. 36 hours, a day and a half. He pulls up the latest telemetry from Astrometrics. They're not far from Earth, but Starbase 1 is in the opposite direction. Jupiter is not far, but the Farragut is on mission, and taking a detour will ask questions. He could take a shuttle, of course, run as fast as he can. He puts his face in his hands and bites back the streak of panic that courses through him. He turned up on the ship, relaxed and fucked out with Spock, and was so petulant that he couldn't put his boyfriend in his bunk after a dirty weekend, all the while this was happening. The captain knows he's got a messy love life, but God, he's met Carol multiple times. He likes her. He doesn't know about the baby. He never really asked. Surely just assumes that they broke up and now Jim is with Spock and now he has to go and tell his boss what he's done, knowing that Reuben will have a lot to say about it, not least that old girlfriends should not be repeating on you like bad food, not when you're XO. Okay, Jim says to himself and pulls himself together and, grabbing his pad, heads out. Computer, whereabouts of Captain Reuben? Captain Reuben is in his ready room. It is only just the start of the gamma shift now, and Jim knows that the captain likes taking the night shift one shift in four to, quote, keep his hand in. He knows a lot about Reuben after these months serving together. That is somewhat part of his job, to be indispensable, to be inside his captain's head and know what card he'll play next. And so Jim made it his goal to learn the captain's hand, and he's held this particular card up his sleeve for a while, hoping he'll never have to use it. He presses the chime and is called through a few moments later. Captain, can I speak to you? Jim asks. And Reuben beckons him and points at the chair. Jim sits down, wringing his hands. Go on, Reuben says. It's late. I have to go unnerve the night shift kids in a bit. I actually need to speak to Sid, Jim says, raising his eyebrows significantly, and Reuben furrows his brow in return and presses a button on his desk. Okay, son, you've got my attention. Captain, hat is off. Lay it on me. Jim exhales, purses his lips, and nods his head a few times. Carol is pregnant, about 6 months along, but she called me to tell me that there's a problem and she's going to have the baby in the next 36 hours, and I need to be there. Sid, to his credit, doesn't say anything, just pulls up the same Atrometrics report that Jim is clutching in his sweaty hands. Earth or Starbase One, he asks, prodding at the terminal. Starbase One, sir. Sid. Sid huffs a mirthless laugh through his nose. Okay, I think we can probably swing it. Helps that we've got that prisoner on board and Jag are on the Starbase these days. Gives us a good reason to detour. We were going to Earth, but Starbase One works, he says. But Jim, I'm here for you. God knows I've had my own relationship problems, but does Spock know? Jim sighs. He doesn't. Sid shakes his head. Tell him. Tell him now. Don't let him hear from anyone else. You've kept this quiet, and that is impressive, if only because I didn't think you had that level of discretion in you. But as I said when I promoted you, you can't be grist in the gossip mill when you're XO. You have to be squeaky clean, and this is messy as all hell. I know, Jim says. Sid, I know. Spock is different. It wasn't supposed to be this. He was supposed to just be a fling. Well, Carol and I were off again, a last hurrah before the baby. But he's something else. God, I know how it sounds, but I can't. He's interrupted by the highest priority trill of his communicator. Even though Jim has not been head of security for several months now, a good 10% of his comms are from people who still contact him on autopilot. He glares at his communicator and answers it. Kirk here. Commander Kirk. A voice comes over the comm. We have a security alert on Deck 9. Call Lieutenant Shi. She's security chief, he says tetchily. This is Lieutenant Shi, the voice says apologetically. I mean, she's the security alert. I'm so sorry, sir, but Sarissa has taken her hostage. Sarissa? Oh, God, I'm on my way. He hangs up. Go, Sid says and presses the unlock button. But do what I said, okay? Aye, Sid, Jim says, and runs out the door. Jim rounds up a few security ensigns to be back up alongside one of the flashier new phasers from the armory, and then after a quick briefing from Ensign Zarea, who is the one who had called in the problem, squares his shoulders and steps confidently into the brig. The first thing he sees is Lieutenant Shi standing behind the force field, looking sheepish and shaking her head frantically at him to warn him. But this isn't Jim's first rodeo. He knows this room like the back of his hand. There's only one real place to hide. True to form, his target is nestled in the corner like a spider biding his time. Glad to see you, Devere oozes. And Jim swings round to find him at the console, holding a phaser and looking like a bizarro pinup from one of Jim's weirder fantasies. A handsome Vulcan draped across the security office chair, his jumpsuit open to the navel, exposing a frankly impressive chest and smorgasbord of abdominal muscles. "I suppose you have questions," DeVere says, eyes flinty and calculating. Security officers are trained for situations such as this. Starfleet has run into more than its fair share of handsome honeypot megalomaniacs. There's only so much role play that one can do, though. And over time, the training against beautiful strangers who just want a taste of your regulation sideburns and hot, throbbing command codes wears off. Luckily for the Farragut, Jim keeps his certifications bang up to date. Jim looks at this impossibly handsome man, offering him all the rock-hard abs and answers, and just shrugs and stuns him without replying. "Not really," he says, finally, as DeVere slumps to the floor, and then turns away from his sprawled form to face the brig. "Now you need to answer some questions," he says to Tamsin, as he leans over the desk and presses the button to deactivate the force field. "First help me drag him in, and then we're going to my office for a debrief." Tamsin is a good officer, but she's not listening. Instead, she's gazing at DeVere on the floor. "How could you?" she warbles, and Jim sighs. "Zareya." Zareya pokes her scaly head around the door. "Help me with him," he gestures. And together, Zareya and Jim drag their unconscious guest back into the cell, all while Tamsin gazes at DeVere with the wet eyes of someone who has entirely lost it. Jim raises the force field and sets it to a higher intensity, only to turn around and see Tamsin lovingly trailing her fingers along it anyway, as tears leak from her eyes. Jim leaves Zareya in charge and turns Tamsin gently in order to frog march her down to the turbo lift. But as they leave, they almost immediately bump into Spock. There's a set to Spock's jaw that Jim desperately wants to investigate, but Tamsin is starting to wriggle, and so he clasps her tighter and grimaces. "DeVere escaped and has done something to her," Jim explains. "I'm sorry. I'll have to catch up with you later." "I understand, but Jim, just a minute of your time," Spock says. And Jim, only human, falters. But that is the moment Tamsin makes a run for it. Jim sprints off after her immediately, but manages to turn around just enough to be able to yell, "Find Petra, she'll help you with anything," before he disappears around the corner. Spock finds Commander Adelaide in her office, where upon first appearance she is buried in a report. However, the large frame print of a nebula reflects her screen perfectly, and Spock notes with interest that she's actually about halfway through doing the daily fleet crossword. "Commander Kirk told me to find you," he says, clasping his hands behind his back. Adelaide mock startles, as if only just realizing someone is in the room with her, even though she buzzed him in. "Okay, I'm busy," Spock presses the issue. "He is dealing with the problem with the prisoner. I regret asking the favor, but I am here on an official task and require introductions to the science division, and it is customary that this will be done by a member of the line." Petra frowns. "Forbear," Spock says, apropos of nothing. "I'm sorry," Petra says, after warning put up with distant relative. "Forbear. Seven across." Petra raises an eyebrow. "Okay, brains, I can make some introductions, but first, 13 down," she asks. "Game with tiny, subtle signals, 11 letters. Spock thinks for a moment. Tiddlywinks. There's some furious typing, and then Petra grins. "Right, right. Suck it, Jenny. Beat you this time. I swear this thing is set every day to make everyone in the fleet feel stupid. Right, I need more coffee. Walk with me and let's go introduce you to Mr. Goodenough, and then I'll get myself back to work." "That is an unflattering nickname for a senior member of staff. Is it supposed to be ironic?" Spock raises an eyebrow as they fall in step outside the door. "You'll see," Commander Adelaide says, and leads him to the fourth deck kitchen, sliding into the small gap where a mostly regulation coffee pot sits gently steaming. "I hope Jim isn't getting caught up in too many shenanigans this morning. We have a staffing meeting at 10:30. She pours in a generous stream of milk, but does not offer Spock any refreshments, or at least is distracted before she can, and nudges Spock in the ribs, beaming as she spots a large man walking towards them. "Here he is," she mutters, and then at a more normal volume calls out to the new visitor, "Speak of the devil. Craig, I think I have something of yours. Lieutenant Spock, may I formally introduce you to Commander Craig Goodenough in line with Starfleet Regulation 84.2. Upon the arrival of an auditor, here is your prey. Craig, I'll leave you to get acquainted." She puts her hands on Spock's shoulders and leans in conspiratorially. "Try not to break this one too quickly," she says sotto voce. "Rumor is Jim likes him a whole bunch," she says, twirling her finger around suggestively and winks. And Spock feels himself turn a pale green as Commander Goodenough looks up and grins at him with the guile of a particularly hungry shark. "Mr. Spock," the man, who is apparently actually named Goodenough, says, executing a particularly poor ta'al with his thick fingers. His voice is deep with a strange brogue that Spock cannot immediately place, but he is undeniably human, with dark burnished skin and a neat fringe of ruddy brown hair encircling his head tonsure-like, just long enough to be tied in a ponytail. "Nice to meet you. I formally accept your arrival as Starfleet's auditor. Shall we start with a tour of the sciences deck?" Sciences are on Deck 3, and Spock is politely escorted around the various laboratories with nerdy excitement. Commander Goodenough is a pleasant man, but Spock is distracted because he still cannot place his accent. They enter the biological sciences lab, and Goodenough claps his hand on Spock's shoulder. "Right, best for last. We've got L.T. Morley, who I think you met before, and that's Nando over there." Slight alien of unknown race waves awkwardly, and Goodenough whispers, "She's shy, but she's a big fan," before picking up his voice and looking around. "Where's the colonel got to?" he says. "Can't you cunt stay where I put you for a fucking moment?" "Ah," Spock says, memory finally clicking into place. "Apologies, I had not placed your accent before now. You are Australian." Goodenough stares at him and then doubles over in laughter. "Well, fuck. The secret's out, I guess. Let's get into the boardroom before word spreads." Across the ship in Jim's office, Lieutenant Shi looks at least contrite, if still a little woozy. She's staring at her hand like it contains the keys to the universe. "Did he hurt you?" Jim asks her carefully. "You can tell me. It won't go beyond these walls if you don't want it to." "No, sir," she says, hiding her hand behind her back. "No, are you kidding me? It's Sarissa. I touched him. I don't know if I can ever wash this hand again." She brandishes her entirely normal hand for him to see, gazing at it as if it contains the secrets of the universe. Jim puts on his best concerned furrow and leans against the desk. "Tamsin, you are one of my best officers. I hand-picked you to be my successor in the important job of keeping this ship safe and armed to the teeth. I think you need to go to sickbay. This isn't like you." "It's just, he can't be bad, right?" she says wistfully, obviously not listening. "Have you seen him dance? It's so hypnotic," they both say, and Jim sighs and signals for sickbay to come down to his office. "It's okay, Tam," he says gently. "We'll get this sorted." A few minutes later, during which Jim endured Tamsin's ranking of the LLAP singles and speculation around Sarissa's sexuality, there's a knock at the door and Jim instructs the med team to enter. As they're fussing over her, there's another knock and the worried smile of Ensign Zaria appears around the edge. "Sir," Zaria reappears behind them. "Sorry, it's happened again." Jim just stares at her baffled. "What has happened again?" "The prisoner has escaped," she shrugs. "I'm just the messenger." "You were the guard. Oh, never mind. I'm coming." They jog together back up to the brig, and this time the tableau is different. This time it is one of the medical staff who is sprawled on the floor in just his skivvies, looking dazed and out of it, gazing up lovingly as Devere struggles into the good doctor's trousers, although definitely not in the way the doctor would have preferred. Jim stuns Devere again without pause and then lets out a yell of pain as someone hits him on the back of the neck. It's not very hard, but it's the principle of the thing. Turning, it's one of the other security officers he had come to help Soraya look after Devere. The guard looks at his hand like it has personally betrayed him, but his heart is not in it. What the fuck, Ensign? Put me in the brick, the ensign says hopefully. And that's when Jim sees red. Computer yellow alert, he calls. And the walls light up immediately. Ensign, you are being confined to quarters and you should count yourself lucky you aren't getting thrown out of an airlock. Kirk to Captain Rubin, he says, flicking open his communicator while holding the ensign by the arm with a death grip. We have a security situation on Deck 5. Confine all off-duty staff to quarters and assign everyone else to battle stations. I'm on my way up to explain. The sciences boardroom is cramped. Not because there are a lot of people crammed into the room, but because every spare space has been covered in research projects, all marked with "Do not touch, very important," in a variety of fonts and hands. Take a seat where you can, Goodenough says amiably before sitting down somewhere vaguely near the head of the table. Right, so, Mr. Spock tells me that we have passed our audit. So, boys and girls, you know what that means? We get to have some fun, the others cheer in well-rehearsed sarcastic unison. That's right. And because we're still in transit, Mr. Spock, we get to use you. You're a generalist, right? He asks. Yes, Spock says, bemused. He considers giving his qualifications, but this isn't an interrogation. Goodenough rubs his hands together. Great. Because we have this idea. We're all too hyper-focused on our own favorite things to bring it all together. Anyway, here's the pitch. He holds his hands out in front of himself like introducing a magic act. Biological deflectors. Intriguing, Spock says. Do you have a research protocol? Goodenough grins like he's on a promise. I'd say buy me a drink first, but who am I kidding? Of course we do. Morley, get the lights. Let's give Lieutenant Spock a show. The lights are duly dimmed and the research protocol flashes up on a screen and, well, intriguing does not even begin to describe it. If Spock were asked again, he would describe the approach as approaching fascinating. He points out some issues and makes some recommendations, but before long it passes inspection and he is ushered into the experiment space. It turns out the Farragut has a corridor they have set aside for this form of experiments, and the science team hustles him into a section that could be described as a low-rent particle accelerator, which would be ridiculous since they have about 7 of those that are properly shielded and working. Instead, it just screams, shenanigans. And despite his better instincts, Spock is very partial to science brand shenanigans. Goodenough mans the console and cracks his fingers. Okay, so we did a bypass of this section, and once we move the shields over, we can run the first set of tests. Is everyone ready? Hang on, Nando says, and bolts back into the room before returning with the fire extinguisher. I'm ready. Mr. Spock? I am ready, Spock says. He has been given control of the emergency stop button. It is pleasingly large and red. Deactivating shields, Goodenough says, and the usual deep hum fades. Shields to zero in this portion, the colonel, a large red-skinned man with a friendly face, says. Spock has yet to learn his real name. Shields, huh? What are they good for? Goodenough says. Absolutely nothing, the colonel trills back. Say it again, Goodenough sings, laughing. Absolutely nothing, Spock says, confused, and everyone laughs. Goodenough points at Morley. On that note, take it away, Mauricio, he says, and Morley grins. Biological deflectors to 10%, he says. There's a strange throbbing in the walls, and Goodenough pulls out his tricorder. He says, a little variance, but let's go slowly. 12%, Morley says, and the thrum continues, but again seems to stabilize. Goodenough frowns. Okay, let's call it there. We've got enough data for now. Mr. Spock, can you do the honors?
Spock duly nods and presses the red button. It is very pleasing. With good travel and an audible thunk, he makes a mental note to ask the team for the fabricator recipe. The thrumming stops, but then there's a noise, and Spock feels rather than hears a dull thud. Looking down, there is a large chunk of what appears to be one of the side panels sticking out of his hip. Looking to his right, he notices a trickle of green blood, and Spock frowns at it and tries to move his hand, only to find that he can't. The piece of shrapnel is stuck through his hand, and in turn is stuck to the big red button. That is the moment when a yellow alert siren starts blaring throughout the ship.
Ah, Goodenough says awkwardly, right. In this order, Morley, you call sickbay, I'll call the captain, and then whoever is left, please call my wife and tell her I love her. Fat Commander Kirk's going to kill me.
This is officially a problem, Jim relays to the captain. The yellow alert has the ship on high alert, and the hallways had been silent as he jogged up through them, personnel manning conduits waiting for the worst. I've got three people confined to quarters, and another two on final warnings for either trying to break him out or for breaking rules so that they can get thrown in there with him. He's, I don't know what he is. We don't know anything about him apart from that he looks like a Vulcan. He could be psychic, controlling them somehow. What do the offenders say for themselves? Reuben asks. Nothing much. McCoy? The ones he's looked at indicate that they're all healthy, no signs of mind control. But like I said, we don't know enough about Romulans. Reuben taps his fingers against his mouth. And what does your boyfriend have to say about it? I haven't spoken to him, Jim says. He's been locked in with Goodenough all day, doing some kind of shielding experiment. No one has been able to get anything through to them. Reuben frowns. Well, that is what the shiny override is for, or worst comes to worst. Shove a note under the door. I don't care. We need more information, and Spock is the only Psi active person on board. We don't have the luxury of infinite time or security officers. Jim, I'm giving you the leeway to act creatively.
Understood, sir.
Go and sort this out. I'm canceling the red alert. The lights are giving me a headache. It had been a busy day in sickbay, but McCoy took it upon himself to check out this troublesome prisoner for himself. He is merrily scanning the unconscious, maybe Vulcan, when Jim gets back from reporting to Reuben, dragging another couple of ensigns behind him. This is getting out of hand, he says. I found them tampering with the comms, trying to play a logical time of day over the turbo lifts. I'm putting them in the other brig, but... And Jim elbows the force field for the second cell to open, and McCoy sees just how busy it is with sulking, lovelorn lower deckers. I can't keep it up for much longer. I see the yellow alert has been canceled, McCoy points out, and Jim just ignores him, pulling out a pulse rifle from the arms cupboard and cocking it. Captain's orders, he told me to get creative, but I've decided to do something worse. He sits down, sticking a toothpick between his teeth. McCoy narrows his eyes. Are you all right? But Jim just waves him off. I hope you get lucky, punk, McCoy says and removes himself from the narrative as fast as he can. With Jim now stuck personally glaring at their prisoner from behind a screen and phaser rifle, the crowds that he was personally directing to sickbay have at least calmed down somewhat. McCoy has a lot of work to do, but he's taking a moment with a cup of coffee in his office before he has to write this up. Doctor! The inevitable call comes from the hall, and McCoy sighs and pops his head around the door before realizing who he has been blessed with this time. Why, if it isn't my favorite amateur surgeon, McCoy says, as Spock is led to a bio bed by a gaggle of nerds and helped up onto it. How's the brain, son?
Operating normally, Spock says. It is good to see you, doctor. I wish I could say the same, McCoy says, scanning him. This is a nasty injury. We'll need to operate. How did it happen? We were experimenting with a biomechanical deflector, and it deflected, Spock says.
A little too well, McCoy says, and gently places Spock's hand into the surgical suite and shoos off his entourage, then raises the privacy screen. Okay, I have your medical records. Last update. Yes, the incident. Surely, doctor, you should concentrate on the delicate surgery. This is my dominant hand, Spock says. And McCoy smiles nastily. Oh, you'd be surprised at how well I can multitask, he says. Why don't you start by telling me what benefit biomechanical deflectors would have anyway? Spock frowns. The boundaries of science are there to be pushed, he says. The deflector dish is in a vacuum, McCoy points out reasonably. Nothing biological can live out there. What are you going to graft a beating heart to the outside of the ship to keep the blood flowing? Doctor, as I am head of sciences on the flagship, perhaps you can focus on microsurgery and less on lecturing me about my choice of experiment. I am highly skilled at both microsurgery and lecturing people, McCoy says, firing up the laser scalpel with relish, especially those who, for example, think that affairs of the heart are something to be trifled with. There is a long pause as McCoy and Spock stare at each other. Are you attempting to give me the hurt him and I'll hurt you speech? Spock asks, fascinated. Bit late for that, isn't it? McCoy says. You've already killed him for what, 20 minutes? You're lucky that M'Benga has sticky fingers and no respect for Vulcan property norms, or you'd have been up on manslaughter charges. Perhaps they'd even have tried to get you for murder had they been able to prove that you knew exactly what you were doing. Or if I had been in charge, he thinks to himself. I did not know that breaking the bond would have the effect it did on either of us, Spock says. Surely, doctor, you have my medical records in front of you. You can see that the damage was mutual. Vulcans are known to be self-preserving. Suicide can be logical, but never in the case of romantic entanglements. Therefore, this was unlikely to be the case of murder-suicide. You're also known not to be damn stupid, McCoy says. But yes, let's look at your medical records. Latest update, communications between one Ms. T'Pring and aforementioned good Dr. M'Benga, her advising him that she is a mandated reporter of level 4 psychiatric injury, and due to your betrothal bond, she is considered a witness, and therefore she must report it to the Vulcan authorities. Spock is still discomfited from injury, so attempts to twist to look at the screen despite the fact he's being restrained by the biobed. McCoy continues, Of course, M'Benga needed to alert me to this, since this affects my patient as well. So maybe this is the hurt him and I hurt you talk after all. Does Jim know about your blushing bride-to-be? We have not discussed it directly, Spock says, though I suspect that he may have been told by some of my colleagues on the Enterprise. It has not come up between us. Just didn't have the time while you were canoodling on the bridge at New Year's? McCoy says snidely. I do not want to hurt him, Spock says, choosing to appeal to emotion. T'Pring and I are taking time apart to decide on the future of our relationship, during which time I met Jim, and am intending to formally end my betrothal the next time I am on Vulcan. It is not in my nature to lie. Jim and I are, he trails off, we are important to each other. McCoy huffs and looks to the ceiling in silent prayer. Lord, help me. Anyway, we're done. Your hand is back to normal. He releases the field on the biobed and steps back. Just take this as friendly encouragement, he says quietly. Honesty is the best policy when it comes to Jim. Bring him a problem and he'll break himself and the laws of physics trying to solve it. Hide things from him and you'll see an illogical side of him I don't think you'll be so keen on. Kirk to McCoy, the communicator says, surprising them both. Please report to the captain's ready room and bring Mr. Spock if you have him. I can't raise him on the communicator. Spock puts his hand in his pocket and comes up with a handful of circuits. I believe it was a casualty of the deflector, he says. On our way, McCoy says. Jim has had nightmares about the moment he is in the same room as Spock and McCoy. McCoy knows too much about Spock, about Jim's feelings, and about Spock's sexual prowess, which Jim has mostly told him to wind him up, which works extremely well. He paces the room, waiting for them to arrive, and reassures himself that they have already met, and McCoy didn't even mention it, so it's likely fine. Leonard is a professional. He's a Starfleet doctor. He isn't a gossip. Well, not that much of a gossip.
He can't even convince himself of that one.
Jim catches the captain's raised eyebrow. Please tell me you haven't also knocked up my CMO, Reuben says, accurately deducing the source of Jim's angst with his usual sarcasm and piercing 90% accuracy.
It's not that, Jim reassures him. It's just...
And that's when the door opens. Jim's face curves into a smile at the sight of Spock, something that if he was seeing from the outside, he would grimace at for being way too gooey for being on duty. But thankfully, the captain's ready room doesn't have the weird sex mirrors anymore.
Hey, Jim says.
Hello.
Spock replies, his gaze intense.
Hi, Jim says. They stare at each other for a good few seconds before the captain interrupts.
Gentlemen, Reuben snaps,
while McCoy makes a discreet retching noise behind his back. Less flirting, please. Bring us all up to speed.
Yes, sir, of course, sir, Jim replies, but winks at Spock once Reuben's back is turned and then gives his report again.
Could it be his music? McCoy asks. Some kind of latent mind control thing that only affects those with terrible taste?
Possible, Spock says, though I am not affected, neither is Jim.
I don't like it, though, Jim points out. I never did.
And yet you know all the words, Spock says pedantically.
You'd understand if you had a sibling who did nothing but play the same song over and over again for literal years, Jim retorts. And Spock goes to say something in reply, but stops himself and doesn't say anything.
We can disable the internal speakers and keep him under armed guard by people who dislike the LLAP oeuvre.
I'd also like to make an announcement to the whole crew, something along the lines of, Commander Kirk to all hands, if you let the fucking prisoner out of the brig again, Jim.
Sorry, Captain, he shrugs. In my defense, it has been a very tiring day.
The captain closes his eyes and pinches the bridge of his nose.
Let's continue to follow the book on this one for now. No all-hands threats until lunch at the earliest. Confinement to quarters for the minor stuff, discipline for the middling, see me for the bad stuff.
If I confine any more people to quarters, we'll be flying on a skeleton crew, but at least we'll have the laundry rota sorted for the next few months, Jim grumbles.
Okay, we need to work out what we're going to do.
Reuben nods. I have some good news, though, he says. In light of his attempted hijacking, Brass has asked us to deliver Devere to the Judge Advocate General on Starbase 1 rather than the Vulcan Embassy on Earth, which is convenient for other things. Reuben nods at Jim, and we will be there in less than a day. Meanwhile, we need to get some answers. I don't like having this man running wild on my ship, and we don't know anything about him. Get me something concrete, please, he says, and then walks out.
I hate it when he does that, Jim says, and then sighs.
Let's go find a conference room and work out a plan.
I'll get snacks, McCoy says sarcastically.
So, these are the facts as they stand, Jim says, gesturing at the board. McCoy says that he is Vulcan, though, or at least something very similar. He's got the green blood, the ears, his genome is within the tolerances of the registered Vulcan genome.
Well, mostly, McCoy says. It's hard to make a judgment without more points of reference, and Starfleet's generic database doesn't have access to the VSA, or even the genetic institutes. So I'm just working on the reference genome, which is, by definition, the average. Vulcan is a big place. There's going to be some significant variance across what? 6 billion people?
10,
Spock corrects, and McCoy nods and gestures to support his point.
Jim nods and writes genome heterogeneity on the board to be a show-off, and even spells it right on the first go.
Let's get back to that. Now, what about the news that the Vulcans have disavowed him?
Isn't he some kind of big-time music celebrity? There was apparently concern at the time of their initial success that they were not what they were saying they were, and that the Vulcan Cultural Center were very keen on raising this during the 2240s, Spock explains. However, due to political pressure, they were encouraged to keep their suspicions to themselves. LLAP were considered good for interplanetary relations, even if no one was entirely sure where they came from. What about the other members of the band? Jim asks. Are we looking at a cell or just one bad apple? As you know, Jim, Spock says pointedly, LLAP were a five-piece Vulcan crossover musical combo popular in the 2240s on the core of Federation worlds. Their members were Lyris, lead singer, Torek and Taryn, brothers who provided the close harmonies, Kenevan, who provided the drone, and finally, Sarissa, the beat and choreographer. As for their current status, Lyris was killed in the war during a skirmish between the VSA and the Klingons. He was given a state burial and received a posthumous Federation Medal of Honor. Torek and Taryn are professors of Vulcan music at UC Berkeley. They perform with traditional instruments across the quadrant and seem to have left their popular music habits behind. I was unable to establish Kenevan's whereabouts, however. I wonder if Sam knows, Jim wonders, pulling out his communicator. I doubt that your brother would know more than the Central Starfleet Repository, Spock says haughtily. I mean, you're his boss, Jim chuckles, typing on his comm, spinning it across his knuckles as he munches on a snack. The comm buzzes a scant minute later, and Jim reads it, then raises his eyebrows and smugly turns to show Spock his screen. J.T. Kirk. Hey, do you know what happened to Kenevan from LLAP? G.S. Kirk. Ori saw him on a signing tour last year. He's got a new album coming out. He's on Beta Z, A-F-A-I-K. His third wife is from there, but rumor is they're on the outs. Why? Sam met his wife in the LLAP fan club when they were 16, Jim says to McCoy smugly. The first dance at their wedding was to The Thread of Choice. A rather obvious selection, Spock says, more than a little bitchily. But this means we cannot discount that Kenevan and DeVere are still working together. Right, Jim says and writes, Kenevan on Beta Z on the board. That's a lead. Okay, I'll get in touch with Beta Z Planetary Security and see what they have to say. Their security service is pretty thorough. And then I'll go and stare at this prisoner for the next 8 hours. Spock, if you can contact the Vulcan Cultural Center, see it being proven right after 20 years makes them loosen their tongues. Spock inclines his head and uses it to look at Jim through his eyelashes, the way he does when he's finding Jim's professionalism arousing. McCoy clears his throat loudly and Jim claps his hands. Okay, coming back to the genetics question, how do we get access to the right databases? We could make an application, but the bureaucracy is pretty heavy. It'd be simpler if we knew someone who had access, who owes us a favor, McCoy says. But I don't think anyone on board does. We can ask, though. We do know someone with the access, Spock realizes. Christine Chapel. She is primarily employed by the Stanford Morehouse Epigenetic Project. She does not owe me a favor, but I can send her a message and ask her to cross-check it against her available databases and owe her one in return. McCoy nods in agreement. Let me take this one. I've been meaning to contact her anyway, and she's probably drunk enough of the whiskey I gave her to know I mean business. Jim writes Chapel genetic access on the board for completeness sake, and then turns off the pen with a flourish. Right, we each have a job. Keep in touch. Let me know what you find. I'll go report to the captain. Jim's refrain, the last day, has been for Spock to ask Commander Adelaide if he needs help, and so, finding himself without a functional communicator and without the requisite permissions to access the long-distance array anyway, Spock returns to Commander Adelaide's office for the second time that day. Commander, he says, knocking politely on the door, I was wondering if you could help me with a task. Sure, she says. I'm almost done with this. And Spock watches her click off the fleet's daily killer Sudoku and back onto a report in the reflection behind her desk. What do you need?
I must contact the Vulcan Cultural Center. However, I believe this request will come better from Starfleet rather than from me personally.
Sure, Adelaide says. Take a seat.
This about Jim's new best friend? She asks as she searches for the number.
Affirmative.
Devere is proving to be a mystery. Captain Rubin has tasked Jim, McCoy, and I to solve it.
I'm sure you'll crack it, she says, sighing.
I haven't told Jim, but I used to love LLAP so much as a girl, she says in her flawless Vulcan. It's how I got interested in learning Vulcan myself. There's a lot in hindsight that's weird, though. They were always a bit illogical for Vulcans.
It is on this that we are hoping that the Cultural Center will have done some research, Spock replies. As I understand, I too was a fan as a boy. Jim finds it strange and hilarious. However, I must confess that I still listen to their third album on occasion. The runtime and MBP is conducive to an optimal pace for the Officer's Fitness Test 5K.
Your secret is safe with me, Petra says, and then swings her screen around to show her dialer and the personnel list of the Cultural Center. Let's do this. Who do you think we should ask?
They decide on the deputy lead of the music department and are swiftly deposited into the heart of the Vulcan bureaucracy's phone tree. The hold music is a tinny lute interpretation of a famous ballad that Spock cannot quite identify, but Petra does, by the smile on her lips.
Spock, may I ask a bold question? Petra says, and purposefully mouses over the controls to show that they are on mute. What is happening between you and Jim? Is it serious?
It is, Spock replies. Why do you ask?
Petra takes a deep breath. Does he know about your betrothed?
You are the second person to ask me this today, Spock replies.
That is not an answer. Petra raises an eyebrow. Are you worried that he does not understand the cultural impact of being unattached and male in Vulcan society?
There is much that Jim does not know about Vulcan society, Spock says bitterly. For example, he booked a dinner at Lang Varde restaurant while we were on vacation and did not recognize the implication.
I am so sorry, Petra says, her hand in front of her mouth in shock, dropping back into standard.
I believe he just wanted to take me out for dinner to somewhere I would enjoy the cuisine, Spock says archly. But equally, I am sure that we were recognized by the manager. It is likely already being discussed in Shikar. I have two missed calls from my mother that I cannot bring myself to return as yet.
Petra looks conflicted, as if she wants to confirm this. But before he can ask her, a haughty Vulcan voice comes over the comm, and with a grin, she puts on her best Starfleet voice and winks as she purposely wrongly conjugates her verbs to lull their contact into a false sense of security. Spock takes notes on his pad as Petra charms and manipulates the poor Vulcan civil servant into giving her everything she wants and more besides, and then signs off by dropping the act, giving a flawless final salutation and signing off.
Works every time, she says, cracking her knuckles. They cannot help but show off when they think that you're just a stupid human.
It has been an honor to see your methods up close, Spock says, and extends the ta'al to her. Petra matches it, and he then leaves. The moment the door shuts, Petra's face falls and she puts her head in her hands.
Jim, you idiot, she mutters, and flips open her communicator.
Adelaide to Kirk, we have to talk.
She waits 30 seconds, but there is no answer, and she is also not prompted to send a message to voicemail.
Interesting. Computer, where is Commander Kirk?
Commander Kirk is in his office.
Christine answers her comm on the third ring. In the artificially blurred background, Leonard recognizes the characteristic shapes of the Starfleet Academy dorms, the lumpy bed and the red lamp shackled to the wall like something out of a particularly fashionable prison block, and feels nostalgic.
Dr. McCoy, Christine says, great to hear from you. I loved the whiskey. I used it to break the ice with my fellowship fellows, and let's say two of them got married that same night.
Good to hear, Christine,
Leonard says. I was hoping to have lubricated you up enough to ask you for a favor.
Whatever you need, Christine says readily.
Leonard explains the saga of Sarissa to the best of his ability, and to his credit, far less editorializing about Jim and Spock than he would if he was telling it to anyone else. Christine nods along to his explanation.
Yeah, sure. Have you got the sequence handy?
Sending it over now, Leonard says. And Christine mutes herself and turns to another screen, tapping away with a frown on her pretty face. She's changed her hair. Still that white blonde, but she's cut it shorter, and it suits her. He thinks about telling her, but then sees himself in the little image in the corner and thinks better of it. Leonard sits awkwardly for 5 minutes until Christine comes off mute.
Okay, I've got good news and weird news, she says. The sample's closest match that isn't from Vulcan or any of its colonies is DNA from a destroyed Romulan bird of prey, Christine says. We had previously thought they had some Vulcan prisoner of war that had slipped through the cracks, but perhaps this explains things a bit better.
Leonard frowns. So he's a Romulan who's been genetically altered to appear Vulcan?
Christine shakes her head.
Potentially. If so, it's very good work, incredibly subtle. You can barely tell anything has been changed in his genome. I guess we're in unfamiliar territory. After all, we're used to the Klingon approach to genetic experimentations. And I don't know if you know anything about that, but it involves a lot of sawing and physical changes that you can't really hide from a level 4 scan. But if this is true, whatever the Romulans are doing is light years ahead of what we've seen. It's as if he is Vulcan, altered to appear Romulan, then altered to appear Vulcan again.
Leonard rubs his hands against his face and sighs. Okay. Can you share any of that with me officially, or is it just gossip?
Christine grins, and a file appears in his inbox.
First-class service, she says. Is there anything else you need, Doc?
Leonard almost signs off, but he likes Christine a lot, and so he grimaces.
Look, please take this in the manner I mean it, which is as a friend who also has problems with sharing things I'm not supposed to. I know you told Spock's fiancé about the medical crisis with him and Jim.
Christine's face goes from open and friendly to grim in a split second, but Leonard continues. As far as anyone knows, T'Pring called Mbenga and Mbenga told me. All kosher, medical professional to medical professional. But I need you to know that T'Pring called me and told me things about Jim she would not have known unless she had been in the room. Not to mention she told me that you had given her my name as Jim's medical contact.
Right, Christine says, looking furious and guilty. I'm sorry.
Leonard nods. Like I said, I'm not going to tell anyone else. And I owe you massively for this, and God knows that I am guilty of this myself, just from one loose-lipped goose to another. Be careful. It's a smaller galaxy than you think.
Christine forces a smile. Sure, Doc. Thanks for the heads up. I have a lecture now, so I must go. Let me know if there's anything else you need, she says, and then hangs up before he can even say goodbye.
Jim comes in at that moment, distracting Leonard from his own hangdog reflection in the black screen.
Got a minute?
What is it? Leonard replies.
I need you to look over this, Jim says, stone-faced, and Leonard takes the pad and scans the top line and raises an eyebrow.
Carol? He asks, and Jim nods.
She asks for a second opinion.
Leonard looks it over and purses his lips. It's a dangerous situation, I won't lie. This could very well go badly. But they've covered all the bases I can see.
Jim slumps down into the chair. He looks so young, all of a sudden, like the young father he is about to become.
Jim, she's in good hands, Leonard reassures him.
They both are. Worst comes to worst. Starbase One has cutting-edge medical transporter. They'll whip him out if they have to.
Jim lets out a shaky breath and gestures for the pad back.
Thanks. I'll let her know.
We're redirecting there, I think. We need to hand our guest over anyway.
Jim, does Spock know?
Leonard asks gently. silently fuming that he seems to be having the same damn conversation twice in one day. But Jim looks at him and doesn't say anything, just grimaces. "Jim," Leonard says softly, "you fucking idiot. How long has this been going on now? 4 or 5 months? I didn't think. There never was a good time. I didn't want to think about it. Then there was the whole bond thing." "Babies never come on schedule," Leonard says. "Neither do bonds or handsome Vulcans. But this son of yours coming now proves that he at least has a great sense of timing." Jim laughs at that. "I will tell him that, I promise." He gets up, pulling himself back into the shape of a first officer. "I won't tell Spock you said he's handsome. Your secret's safe with me." He winks and leaves Leonard to his sputtering. Jim goes back to his watch in the security office, pulling up his messages and beginning the enormous task of writing up everyone who is still sulking in the brig. He doesn't intend to fall asleep, but whether it's the effects of the sound-deadening privacy screen in front of the brig to hopefully block any psychic powers or secret messages inscribed in the handsome planes of De Beer's face, or just the boredom of doing paperwork alone in a corner once again, the lack of stimulus does what it inevitably does. He wakes up with a jerk at his desk, drooling onto a pad, scrabbling for the chronometer. He hasn't a clue how long he's been asleep. But with a pang of dread, he hears the faint thump of bass and oddly familiar music echoing through the halls and sees that both the brig cells are once again empty of their famous charge and his adoring fans. He follows the sound as if in a dream, down the hall, through a conduit, and along a Jeffries tube until he ends up in the mess. The Farragut's mess isn't like any of the ones on the Enterprise. There's not usually a stage in the middle for one, and the lighting is more functional than the strobing blue and purple living migraines that are currently bombarding his senses. People also usually are sitting down, not packed 3 meters deep, and gyrating like they're at a festival. High above them on the stage, of course, is De Beer. He's dancing sinuously to the greatest hits of LLAP, perched somewhere in the vicinity of the lap of the Farragut's chief engineer, Diane Morwood. She's got good moves for a woman of her age, Jim thinks faintly. The song finishes, and De Beer helps Commander Morwood back into the crowd and then dramatically points at the ceiling as the collected crew go absolutely wild. Jim is jostled as a good third of the crew start losing their absolute shit to LLAP's breakout hit, a Vulcan language cover of some 20th century song about what else being logical. He waves his hand in front of Ensign Serial's face as he gyrates and gurns, and looking to the ceiling, he decides he's absolutely fucking done with this. There's a chair, unoccupied, next to the stage, and Jim swim dances his way over to it, then jumps up easily, pulls out his phaser, and stuns De Beer before he even gets the chance to see him. De Beer starts to fall, and Jim jumps across, catching him as he falls off the stage and into the arms of his adoring crowd. He puts him into the chair that had recently been vacated by Commander Morwood before turning to the crew with pure rage on his face. They're all standing around looking baffled and a little angry, but Jim's got a fully charged phaser and absolutely no fucking patience left. The shouting starts, a ripple of dissent that spills out across the crowd, and he puts his finger on the trigger and raises his arm to fire a warning shot at the ceiling. But then there is a horrible stabbing pinch in his shoulder and everything goes black. He comes to and finds Spock leaning over him. "De Beer has escaped with the help of some of the crew," he says. "The partygoers are all confined to quarters. Captain Rubin wishes to see you after you have been to sickbay." "I'm fine," Jim says, standing up and then immediately slumping back down. "Okay, maybe not." Spock puts his hand into his pocket and frowns before reaching into Jim's pocket and flipping open the dented communicator. "Dr. McCoy, to the officer's mess, please," Spock says into his borrowed comm, and the indistinct grumbling on the other end makes Jim smile faintly. McCoy arrives a few minutes later and scowls at Jim while pulling out his tricorder and scanning him. "You got the Vulcan whammy," McCoy says, and to Jim's surprise turns to glare at Spock. "I expected better of you, just because—" "Not him," Jim interrupts. Our guest in the brig. McCoy looks confused. How did that happen? People keep letting him out. It is very annoying. The main question is, how did he do the Vulcan whammy? Jim asks, grimacing as he pulls himself up to seating. McCoy answers that. Easy. He's something else made to look Vulcan. Christine ran the DNA. Romulan or something like it. Spock nods. I was coming to find you to share the same information. The working theory from the Vulcan Cultural Center is that the minds and funding behind LLAP were Romulan. However, whether the individuals involved are Vulcan citizens is hotly debated. Also, while I disagree with your nomenclature, what he performed on Commander Kirk was absolutely a chose votre, a Vulcan nerve pinch. But if he isn't really Vulcan, how did he do the Vulcan whammy? McCoy asks. Many people can learn the chose votre, Spock says, even those who are Cy-Null. It is, as they say, all in the wrist. Teach me it sometime, Jim says, woozily, but with definite intent. And Spock flexes his wrist flirtatiously in reply. McCoy grunts and jabs Jim with the hypo spray harder than is probably necessary. You'll be fine in 5, he says. We have to track him down, Jim says, rotating his shoulder and wincing. Anyone not in his thrall needs to grab a pulse rifle and start hunting. He's a slippery one, so sensors are just an indication of a direction, nothing more. I believe with the information Dr. McCoy has provided, I may be able to calibrate the internal sensors to better track the prisoner, Spock says, and Jim nods. It's a plan. Stay in constant contact, Jim says. Regular check-ins. We have to keep the ship safe. Stop this once and for all. No one else is getting whammied tonight. I still do not have my comm, Spock says, holding up Jim's that he had commandeered. Jim gestures for him to keep it. I'll get another one out of the stores on my way to brief the captain, he says. The hallways of the Farragut are blissfully quiet, which at least makes it easier for Jim to hear Spock and McCoy arguing in his earpiece. Jim, I believe that the prisoner is on deck 6, aft, Spock says. Roger, Jim says, and nods to Ensign Zarea, who is covering his flank. Deck 6, we can take the conduit just up here. Zarea asks to go first, and so Jim watches her wiggle down the ladder in her charmingly serpentine way, all while McCoy gives him updates. I'm worried that we still don't know how he's doing it, he says. We've disabled all speakers on board other than your earpieces, but I recommend taking them out once we have triangulated his position. It's very likely that there is some kind of brainwashing in that music of his. That is merely a hypothesis, Spock says. It does not explain everything. Did I say it explained everything? McCoy snipes. No, I don't think so. Obviously, there are other elements to this. For example, most of the affected crew are within a certain age range. Most have used the transporter in the week before Devere came on board. All are human. Are you positing that this could be spread to humans of a certain age through the transporters? Perhaps neuroplasticity could be an element, Spock asks. And Jim knows he's winding McCoy up and bites his lip when Leonard immediately falls for it. Of course I don't. That's stupid. I don't know how you are the head of sciences. Some kind of Vulcan preferential treatment, no doubt. Gentlemen, Jim says, Zarea having given the all clear. Although this is greatly amusing, perhaps you could tell me what your theories are rather than what they are not. All those affected are human and have previously indicated some preference for LLAP, either through their listening habits or consumption of other media and news. More women than men have shown susceptibility broadly along the distribution of human sexuality, i.e. about 55% of women and 20% of men have gone for him. They're all in their 30s and 40s, a few a bit younger. The only part we didn't know is that all are frontline Klingon war wounded. They've all been through various rehabilitations. Nothing concrete there yet. I don't have access to the details for a lot of them. Record keeping went to shit in the war. Interesting, Jim says, sliding down the ladder and landing like a cat at the bottom. Keep searching, but I will be going silent. See you on the other side. The halls on deck 6 are empty, but unlike those on deck 8, the lights are off. Zareya already has her headlamp on, and so Jim clicks his on, as well as the tracer light on the rifle. He also takes out his earpiece, drops it down, and crushes it under his heel, and gestures to Zareya to do the same. James Kirk, a voice calls out from the dark. You are an interesting specimen. I've had so much fun reading and learning about you from your friends and colleagues. What is there to know? Jim calls back, and then gives a silent gesture for Zareya to circle around low, and she drops to her belly, slithering into the darkness. I'm just a Starfleet officer. Can't carry a tune in a bucket, not like you. Now, a man like you, a lover in every port, decorated soldier, youngest XO, let's see. Mummy a Commodore. Daddy is just a commander, I see. Positively Romulan. I wouldn't know, Jim says. No one has ever seen a Romulan. But that's not true, is it? Not technically. Oh, you'd struggle to prove that. I'm as Vulcan as Spock. So you're half Romulan, got it, Jim mutters, and then sees something, a flicker of light in his peripheral vision, and drops to the floor just as Devere appears out of the shadows and lunges. Jim rolls and keeps rolling, staying low, bracing the rifle across his body in preparation for taking a shot. Devere has some kind of blade jammed between his fingers and is slashing wildly, twisting and spinning, whirling like a dervish. He moves supernaturally fast, so fast that Jim is losing, his boots scrabbling in the carpet, brute strength and quick reflexes his only real weapons left as the rifle gets in the way and he lets it go, the strap almost strangling him as he scrambles. With a final lunge, Devere has him, and he's pinned with a knife to his throat on the carpet. Devere's grin is triumphant, but Jim has one more weapon up his sleeve. How did you do it, Devere? Jim goads. You've got me. I'm dead, but please, I need to know, what do the veterans have to do with it? Devere shakes back his hair and tightens his grip on his knife. Oh, Mr. Kirk, the things you don't know are as beautiful as the stars themselves. The great Romulan Star Empire has so much in store for you. I'm almost tempted to spare you just to see the look on your face when we take everything from you, when we crush your pathetic Federation into dust. The veterans are just the start. Thankfully, there's the sound of a phaser firing, and Devere's handsome brow furrows, and he slumps down over Jim, who with a final push of strength manages to get his arms up so that the knife doesn't finish the job through gravity. He whimpers under the weight as he feels the knife dig into his arms, but then Zareya is pulling Devere up and handcuffing his limped body. Are you all right, sir? She asks, offering a hand up. He almost had me, Jim says, leaning forward to catch his breath. He strips off his jersey and wraps it around his lacerated arm, watching as the blood turns it from command to operations. Thankfully, I followed my training. Keep them talking and hope they loved a monologue. Remember that, Ensign, and you'll go far. Roger, she says, and pulls out her communicator. Ensign Zareya to Captain Rubin. We've caught the prisoner. The red alert can be canceled and the lights and turbolifts restored. Please send someone from sickbay to look at Commander Kirk. Thank you, Ensign, the captain says. Tell Jim we're on the way. Good job. A few hours later, Jim is in his office, having fled there after McCoy had fixed his arms and kept trying to tell him his opinions on Spock. There's a chime at the door, and Commander Adelaide bustles in with a tray of food and a steely expression on her face. Jim raises his phaser and points it at her. Before you come in, who is the best LLAP member? He asks, finger on the trigger. Petra rolls her eyes. Kenevan, duh, she says, and Jim puts down the phaser. Petra sits down. I figured you would have stopped eating once things became stressful, so I made you a care package. It's extremely bad for you, but if the doc asks, there was at least one vegetable. She points at a baked potato with cheese and sour cream, which indeed does have some chives sprinkled across the top. You know me too well, Jim replies, and pulls the tray in. You're getting promoted. You can have my job starting tomorrow. I'm done with this. I'm going to retire to Andor and farm ice.
Petra shakes her head and picks a fry off his plate, chewing thoughtfully.
No thanks. Seems too much like hard work.
Did you get my message from earlier? She asks, voice dripping with fake nonchalance.
The burger is good, and he savors it around the lump in his throat.
You said we have to talk, and okay, since we aren't dating, I'm not as worried as I would be, but still, that's not a message a man's heart can take out of the blue.
He reaches under his desk and presses a button hidden there for emergencies, quickies, and emergency quickies.
I've locked the door. Speak your mind.
You're fucking this up, Petra says honestly.
I can't even begin to explain how much you're fucking this up, but as your friend, I am here to try.
You're going to have to be more specific, Jim says, hiding his anxiety in another bite.
I'm talking about Spock.
Christ, Jim. I don't want to speak out of turn, but
no, do. Petra, please, I need to save this. I love him.
Petra grimaces.
Okay. Lord, where do I start? I won't bother asking whether you know anything about Vulcan culture because it's obvious that you don't. Do any of these words mean anything to you?
Asheam,
Tresh Naval,
Tahila,
Shikar Inval,
Cree Longe.
Spock called me Asheam once as he... Shikar is the capital city, but otherwise, no. I took Andorian at the academy.
Okay, in order.
Beloved.
Engagement.
Soulmate.
Capital ceremony, a.k.a. shotgun wedding, but for people who have only just discovered emotions and preservation of the line through strategic marriage. These are the core terms of Vulcan courtship that you are going to need to get very comfortable with in the near future.
Petra, Jim says, mopping up sauce with a bundle of fries like a savage.
I say this because, at minimum, this is what you should know when dating a Vulcan.
Look, I don't have time to explain exactly why, but you have to propose to Spock as soon as possible.
She looks at her chrono.
Now would be perfect, actually.
Jim sighs.
Petra, I can't. You know me. You know what happened in the war, for one.
It doesn't matter, Petra snaps.
Ugh, how do I even explain this?
Just try.
Okay, what you need to know about Spock is that he was doomed from the start, right? If he'd been raised on Earth, he'd be so much better at this. I don't mean this being all human supremacists, but we are so much better at raising kids with mixed heritage without fucking them up, at least not this badly. I mean, Vulcans barely accept marriage outside of their castes. Honestly, if they hadn't been there at the beginning, there's no way they'd make it into the Federation now. But that's normal Vulcans, and Spock isn't a normal Vulcan.
He's half human, Jim nods, but Petra shakes her head.
I don't mean that. I mean that Spock's family are the closest thing to royalty Vulcan has.
Jim frowns.
So what, he's a prince or something?
Kinda.
It's more complicated than that. They're descended from Serac, like direct firstborn male line, no dilution. And through that, all the other great houses and famous Vulcans have some tie into his family. His great-grandfather was Sulkar, and not any old Sulkar, the original, the one who made first contact and made out with Cochrane in front of all his people. His grandmother is the spiritual leader of all the Vulcan people, and also the current president. She sits on the Federation Council. His dad is the Federation ambassador, and his mom invented the universal translator.
You, my friend, while you are a respectable overachiever, fifth generation fleet, and you'll probably be the youngest captain ever, you are the equivalent of a trailer park gold digger to Vulcans when it comes to their royal family.
Okay, but he's also Starfleet, right? You have to give up claims to thrones, I think,
It's one of those weird bylaws. I had to sign a declaration, and I'm a pure cornbread American farming mutt, descended from Scottish peasants. Oh no, Spock's special. He's got dispensation to keep all his claims, I'm sure. There's no way that Sarek would have let that stand. He may not have his claws in his son anymore, but he's playing the long game. Spock was born to be his father's successor. Probably his grandmother's successor, too, but he'll burn it all down. I don't see what this has to do with me, Jim says, but Petra interrupts him. He's engaged. To a woman. Everyone knows this. What? Jim says. Let me finish. He has a fiance, they all do. It's an arranged marriage situation at the age of, like, 7. Again, the privileges of founder worlds. He's been groomed to marry from childhood, but everyone knows about Spock's fiancée because they all know about Spock. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Your stunt at the Vulcan restaurant is the prime gossip in Shikar right now. What stunt? A nice dinner? A small disagreement? You declared you wanted to make a claim on him, and then took him to a restaurant that basically doubles as a Vulcan consulate where these things happen, and then publicly did not propose even after he prompted you to. And you did it in front of the manager. Okay, but if he's already engaged, Jim says, mind racing. Petra shakes her head. That's not how it works. They don't really have a concept of cheating the same way we do. It's to do with psychic bonds. The legalities don't really matter. It's the bonding that is the mark of cheating. It's fairly common for young Vulcans to date in their 20s and 30s and for adjustments to be made. Jim looks uncomfortable. Wait, Jim, are you bonded? Petra asks, panic rising in her voice. No, I'm not, Jim says. There was a scare, but we aren't. Okay, that's fine. I mean, look, Spock doesn't want her. He wants you, but he can't throw T'Pring over without another betrothal. T'Pring, that's the fiance. She's a woman who actually is a gold digger by Vulcan standards and absolutely proud of it. She is beautiful, intelligent, cultured, and rich, but her family are not from any of the ancient clans. And so it's considered a real coup that her parents managed to match their only daughter with the son of Sarek. If he was anyone else, any other half-human, probably with fertility issues, he'd never make a good match. But from what I've heard, they were queuing up to introduce their little girls to him. And by him, I mean Sarek. She pauses. Does that help? Do you have more cards in your deck now? Jim grimaces. So I need to propose or he'll have to marry her? Petra shakes her head again. Yes and no. Vulcans do get married very quickly once some ceremonial trigger happens. I don't know what it is, though. It doesn't apply to Tamara, so I can't help there. You need to propose because it's the right thing to do for Spock and for the insane people who are way too invested in him. Spock is a bit traditional by our standards, but he's in Starfleet, so he's mostly inured against it. He's been telling Vulcan society to go fuck itself since he was 18, probably earlier. He's their rebel prince. Ironically, there's even rumors one of the LLAP songs is about him. Oh, of all the things to cap off today, Jim says faintly. Petra groans. Think of it this way. You love him. He loves you. You're in the military, which loves marriage. And he's from a marriage-focused culture. There's no-fault divorce in the Federation, even on Vulcan. If this was a novel, there would be a twist, but there isn't. He doesn't care about it. Whatever is holding you back, none of it will matter. Just propose. I'd never ask him for any of this, Jim says, and Petra shakes her head. You don't get it. That's why. He wants nothing from you but you. They stare at each other. Which song? Jim asks eventually. Petra shrugs. Rebel Prince? It's a B-side. I don't know. Ask your brother. How do you even know all of this? A significant portion of Vulcan society spends an enormous amount of time debating the next moves of the son of Sarek, and my girlfriend is one of them. They are obsessed with him. Look, next time you're near a Federation Core world, look up Spock watching on the Alpha Quadrant node of the Coronet. You'll understand, or don't. She stands up, stealing his last fry. Look, I know that you're fresh off a messy human relationship, but it's different for Vulcans. If you love him, propose to him. It will solve everything, I promise. Jim is eventually called away from recovering from Petra's info dump to do his job, and for the first time since yesterday's shift, he manages to actually do some of the things he is employed to do on this ship, and manages to do them for 3 blissful hours before he is called in to talk to the captain once again. "We'll be at Starbase 1 in 2 hours," Ruben says. "Our oldest, beefiest, and most importantly, straightest members of staff are watching Devere, who is shackled and silenced, and I think we're out of the worst of it." "I can't wait until this is finished," Jim says. "Do you know it's only Tuesday? I haven't even showered since I got back from Ryza. There's still sand in my shoes. I had plans, you know, big plans. Now, God, is it always going to be this hard, Sid? You've got kids. Is it like this?" There's a thunk and then a rustling sound as the captain does something on his desk, but Jim continues, staring out the window, barely even listening to anything but the sound of his own voice. "My brother is sure that I'm going to blossom into the galaxy's greatest ever dad, but I just don't know. I think I'm going to be like my dad, the kind of role model who ends up on a pedestal, influencing his son to make the same mistakes as him because he cannot stand looking at anything that isn't a mirror. I mean, I know we turned out all right, but that was more the influence of our mom." Jim, Ruben says, "this is embarrassing, but can you stop monologuing for a moment?" Jim turns around and swears, "Are you fucking kidding me? Devere, this is over. Starfleet Intelligence are on their way right now." "How can it be over if I've taken the captain hostage?" Devere says grandly, spinning his phaser in his fingers before placing it back against the captain's temple. "If I stun you again, you will end up with literal brain damage," Jim explains. "I legally have to tell you that at this point. Please don't make me fill out even more reports." "There will be no reports where you're going, Mr. Kirk," Devere says, and for some reason licks the side of Ruben's face like some kind of cartoon villain. Ruben grimaces and then elbows Devere in the stomach, throwing him to the floor and kicking him sharply in the ribs to keep him there. "This isn't the last you'll see of me," Devere wheezes. "Fuck off, you one-hit wonder," Jim replies and stuns the offended look right off Devere's face. "I am so done with today," he says, as Ruben wipes the side of his face on his sleeve, looking revolted. "What the fuck do people see in him?" "I'll take him down to the brig and sit on him until Tyler's people come get him," Ruben says, hefting Devere onto his shoulder. "Jim, you've been on duty, what, 17 hours? Go find that man of yours and go to bed. That's an order. Just talk to him, Jim. You're annoying all of us now. The only way out is through." "Thank you, sir," Jim says. "I just have one thing I need to do first." He's going to do it. After the chat, knowing what he knows now, he's going to do it. Jim opens his wardrobe and pulls out his dress uniform. He frowns at the pants and sighs. He hasn't had to wear it for a while, but McCoy's plan had worked a little too well. A trip to the uniform synthesizer later, Jim is dressed to ask a question he never really thought he'd be asking. He wants to message someone, but his communicator has once again gone missing with all the grappling and shimmying through conduits, and so he grabs his backup, polishing it on his sleeve before sliding it into his pocket. Walking through the ship, he smiles and nods at his colleagues. "Lost a bet," he says casually to Goodenough, who stops him asking where he's going all dressed up. He laughs and sends him off with a salute. Deck 8. The guest quarters are at the end of the hall, and it feels longer than the ship, paradoxically. He presses the chime and hears Spock call, "Enter." The room is warm. Spock is sitting at the small table, communicator in front of him, wearing just his uniform undershirt and trousers. His jersey is lying on the bed, uncharacteristically messy. "Spock," Jim says formally, a nervous smile playing around his lips, "Asheyam, can I ask you a question?" He'd palmed the little box into his hands as he came through the door. The flocking is sticking to his sweating hands. He takes a deep breath. "Of course," Spock says, "but only if I can ask you one first."
"Anything," Jim says.
Spock raises his head proudly and looks him straight in the eye. "Who is Carol Marcus?" And that is when Jim sees the dent in the case of the communicator, his communicator. "She's my girlfriend," Jim says, and the honesty feels like it's being ripped from him. "My ex-girlfriend, on and off."
"Is that all?" Spock asks.
The metaphorical cat leaps out of the bag and digs its claws into Jim, and he cannot help but face the mixed metaphor head on. "She is also the mother of my child," he says. And it feels so much worse saying it out loud than he had even thought, especially as Spock is sitting there looking like he's been carved out of heartbroken granite.
"I see,"
Spock says. "She was surprised when I answered your communicator. Though in all honesty, I cannot really decide which of us was more surprised. She asked me to tell you that the baby was born last night. He is well, and she has named him David."
"Spock, I meant to tell you."
Spock spits. "Is this why you did not want to be bonded to me?" Spock says, low and furious. "To hide her? To hide a child?"
"No," Jim protests.
"I didn't think of her at all. I only thought of myself, of us."
"I do not know which is worse," Spock ponders, "but there's a cruel edge to it."
Jim is struck silent, his tactical mind racing, fueled by a hurt ego and a deep knowledge that he has fucked up. There is one bullet in the chamber.
"And what of your fiancé?" he fires back. "You're still bonded to her. I know because she contacted my fucking physician and told him, after hearing from your ex-girlfriend, that we are together. Not to mention that my second told me that the whole of Vulcan society knows that you're cheating on her with me. Does everyone know about her but me? If we had remained bonded, what then? Would she have been able to feel my mind as well?"
"We shall never know," Spock says loftily, and gets up and moves to leave.
"No, Spock, wait," Jim says, but Spock just looks at him.
"You were going to ask me something," Spock says, taking in Jim's dress uniform and the small box still clutched in his hand. "I do not think I need to give you an answer, but I will, to make things clear."
"I will not marry you, Jim."
"Not now?"
"Not ever. Please let me leave. There is someone I must apologize to."
"Spock, stop. It isn't like this. We can sort it out, I promise. I'll never do it again."
With a devastating raised eyebrow, Spock opens the door and turns.
"Unlike your son, I was not born yesterday," he says. "Goodbye, Commander Kirk."
The Farragut docks at Starbase One an hour later, and Jim is the first to beam off. Spock does not make an appearance, but Jim didn't expect him to. Any fantasies of final words melted away. Jim beams directly to the infirmary and is directed to the maternity wing, a large bright corridor with a dozen or so rooms, and a flurry of pastel-clad nurses wandering around. His identity chip is scanned and his name cross-referenced, and apparently Carol has yet to take him off the door, so he is brought through into her suite. Carol is asleep, her hair clean and washed but not styled in its usual manner, and she is hooked up to a couple of monitoring machines. Her belly, still swollen, seems still too small to have contained a whole person, but the evidence is there in a bassinet attached to her bed. He hears a noise,
a smacking of lips and a gurgle, and he approaches. His first impression is that he is impossibly tiny, too small to be real. Bright red and wrinkled, with a head downy with blonde hair, he is wrapped in a yellow blanket and covered in monitoring leads, but he is breathing on his own. And when he opens his eyes, they are bright blue, and so alert it takes his breath away. "Hello," Jim whispers, and holds out a finger and touches his son's face for the first time. It is a beautiful moment, one that he will treasure for the rest of his days, but just a moment. Because as soon as his finger makes contact with David's skin, an alarm flares into life and the room is suddenly full of medical personnel. And of course, that is when Carol wakes up and starts yelling at him. He is eventually, after a lot of pleading and tears, given permission to come back the next day, and so goes and finds some accommodation. A hotel in the next dome over takes his credit chip without question. He absolutely could have gone back to the ship or even to Starfleet temporary housing, but he cannot face the questions. Everyone will know by now, whether that he and Spock have broken up or that Carol has had the baby or who knows. Perhaps by now, everyone knows both secrets and he just cannot face it right now. The room is small, but it at least has a tub and there's nothing like room service available. So he heads out to the mini-mart to buy something McCoy would disapprove of for dinner. The shop is vast and full of absolutely nothing of nutritional value, as is tradition, and he's contemplating sending up a flare when he walks around the corner and bumps into, of all people, La'an Noonien Singh. "Commander," she stutters. She's in civvies, clutching a tuna onigiri and a pack of instant noodles in her arms, and her hair is out of its usual tight braids and instead gathered into a messy bun on top of her head, but she still has her eyeliner, though it's a bit smudged at this time of night. "What a surprise. Aren't you and Spock supposed to be loved up on Risa? Aren't you supposed to be minding your own business and saving us all from the Gorn?" he says cruelly, and she frowns at him. "Okay, if you're going to be like that," she says, hurt, and he stops her. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. It's just, Spock and I broke up." La'an looks mildly sympathetic, but still deeply insulted. "I'm sorry, that sucks." He doesn't mean to say it, but it comes pouring out. He found out about Carol, who has had the baby, by the way, and also found out about Spock because she called my comm and he answered. "So they're both done with me. And honestly, I just want to eat instant mac and cheese and drink bad whiskey in my hotel room and ride the wave of self-loathing and my own emotional fuck-uppery. I'm sorry." Out of the corner of his eye, he sees a woman walk around the corner and then back away slowly, muttering something about not getting crisps then, but La'an just nods and turns, picking something off the shelf. "This is the best brand," she says warmly, her fingers stroking his gently, like he's a horse about to bolt. "James, you've got my comm. Call me if you need anything. I've got pretty good at making mistakes these last few weeks," she says, and with a look that borders on sultry, walks away. There's a whole story there, and any other time, Jim would ask her to the bar to get it out of her, and then maybe try his luck at the reciprocal, but he's exhausted and starving and desperately wants to be out of public spaces right now. Back in the room, he sets the food to heat and on automatic picks up his pad and opens the chess app. It takes him a second to realize that something has changed, and then he realizes the last listed match is from 3 months ago with his brother. Everything else is gone. Spock has blocked him. The food heater plays a chime, and Jim pulls his meal out and takes the first bite. La'an is right, at least. This is the best instant mac and cheese he's ever had. What a terribly inauspicious time to learn this. Jim closes the chess app and gives serious consideration to calling La'an and asking her out for revenge sex, not even under the pretense of a drink, just, "Hi, I'd love to be your next mistake. I'm in room 212. But instead, he takes a deep breath and opens the comnet and connects to the AQ node with his private credentials. Petra told him where to look, and it takes only a few clicks to find what he is looking for. AQ Spock Watching. About. A spinoff of AQ Vulcan Royals and AQ Fed Politics Circle Jerk to discuss the son of Sarek, Wiki, a.k.a. Sark Skonson, and Amanda B.A.M.F. Grayson, Wiki, Love Thread. Starfleet's shiniest Nepo baby, Vulcan Society's own rebel prince, Sachin Tagai Spock. Feeling guilty. Jim scrolls down past an impressive list of members to the pinned posts, of which there are two. Weekly Anything Thread number 212. Discussions, Spockulation, and Thirst Posting. Spock fam, you know the drill. Romance discussions are to be contained in the Romance Thread. Weekly Romance Thread number 157. Who is Spock shtipping? Rumors from your cousin's friend's neighbor who once saw the Enterprise through a telescope and totally knows he's divorcing T'Pring any day now go here. No fanfic, for fuck's sake. You know where to post that. Here. He cracks open the whiskey and pours himself a measure, but rethinks it and instead downs half the bottle. He clicks on the romance thread. Started 1 week ago. New thread. JTK Truthers in the house. Roll call time. James T. Kirk is endgame. And for those new or needing a reminder, here is the manifesto evidence list slide deck. Expand. 1,066 messages. Top message. My therapist says I am normal about him, actually. Started 2 days ago. CMB. Spock fucked both Kirk brothers. Plus 456 messages. Top message. This is the only correct theory on this board. OP, you are 200% correct. Started 4 months ago. Forward from previous thread rant. Can the chaos truthers just get over themselves? Like, okay, we've all seen the slide deck. I believe that they had a relationship during the shadowing, but we don't have any concrete evidence other than gossip. No one heard them sing to each other. Yes, they were spotted singing potentially about each other, and we've reconstructed that from reports, but holy fuck, you guys are as bad as the LLAP truthers. Plus 19,438 messages. Top message. This thread just gets funnier with hindsight, especially considered motherfucking Ryza. Lol, OP, die mad about it. Started 3 months ago. Forward from previous thread. Gossip. You guys, my cousin called me. Jim Kirk has a girlfriend on Starbase One, and she's pregnant. Deets and docs inside. Plus 36,554 messages. Top message. No one could prove that she wasn't cheating on him. Have you not read the evidence list? JTK is JT gay. Stop being homophobic. Started 2 hours ago. Off topic. OMG, Federation kids, seriously, get jobs. Stop just sitting on the comnet. Our ancestors didn't nuke themselves into oblivion for this. Plus 495 messages. Top message. Socialist utopia, baby. I'm gonna gossip online and undermine the racist imperialist military complex through gossip, as my foremothers taught me, and there's nothing you can do to stop me. We are the stands World War III could not burn. Jim closes the comnet and stares into space for a moment before picking his new comm up and dialing La'an's number after all. T'Pring is not a believer in fate, as to do so is illogical. However, when she looks at her communicator as she waits for Christine to meet her at their usual tea shop in Paris, and sees that, of all people in the galaxy, Spock is trying to reach her, she frowns at the serendipity. The call ends without her answering, and Christine promptly arrives in her usual whirlwind of blonde hair and overladen bags. For someone who lost most of her belongings first in a war and then in the destruction of the Cayuga, She has quickly attracted enough material goods that it is not noticeable. "Hey, T'Pring," she says warmly, and T'Pring resists the urge to bask. "How's things?" "Things are strange," T'Pring replies and shows Christine Spock's attempts to contact her. "Do you think he's mad at you?" Christine asks, her eyes enormous. "I think that Spock is mad, but as a colloquialism for mentally ill, not as a crude slang word for the emotional response to betrayal," T'Pring says, enjoying the tinkle of Christine's laugh. Jokes in Federation Standard are essentially word puzzles, a way of rearranging language and meaning to achieve a goal. "Are you going to call him back?" Christine asks. She has ordered her usual tea, a grapefruit variety of Earl Grey with blue flowers that bloom in hot water, and a side order of the Talaxian creamer that T'Pring believes is far too sweet. "I will, only to satisfy my curiosity," T'Pring says. "Curiosity is logical," she says, mostly to reassure herself. "Hey," Christine says, grabbing T'Pring's hand and looking at her intently. "We gotta be strong, okay? He's not a bad guy, but you have to prepare for the worst, right? He's probably finally calling you to tell you that he wants to break the engagement." "It is likely. I have been anticipating this day. I have been shielding his thoughts from my own, but there has been a recent surge in his emotionality in the last few hours. I believe that the question has finally burst." Christine smiles despite herself. "How do you feel about it?" T'Pring sighs and looks at Christine reprovingly. "My mental discipline is such that I can answer that question in a way that is helpful to your understanding of our situation. However, please never ask that question to a Vulcan again, unless you wish to be brought up on charges. But to answer your question, I have been preparing for this. I have been cultivating options among other potential suitors. I am fully aware of the illogical nature of the sunk cost fallacy. Nevertheless, I am disappointed to have spent so much time investing in Spock for the outcome to be this unsatisfying." Christine nods sagely. "I feel ya," she says, and the twinkle in her eye at the deliberate use of unhelpful language is obviously a teasing gesture of friendship that humans place great emphasis on. "I only had him for 2 days, but the buildup, so much effort." She grins, raising her eyebrows and dropping the volume and pitch of her voice down. "But I can't deny that he was pretty damn good for it." "I cannot take all the credit," T'Pring replies. The options open up before her, and impulsively she takes the one that is most dangerous. "But I am very glad that he was able to apply his training to such a worthy recipient." A flush of pink on Christine's cheeks proves that T'Pring has once again successfully played the game of verbal chess and won. She appears to be about to say something else, but T'Pring believes in retreating as victor. "I must return to my office," she says, smoothing her skirts down and pressing her credit chip to the slot in the table. "Please accept this as my gift. I shall pass my comments on our latest draft before the end of the business day." "No rush," Christine says absently, distracted by her own calm, and T'Pring leaves. As she walks back to the transporter point, she feels the first droplets of rain. There is a covered seated area nearby, and so she takes cover as the clouds deposit a substantial torrent of water over the Parisian gardens. Lacking a place to put her computer that would provide sufficient ergonomics, considering her neck health, T'Pring decides that it would be logical to call Spock back. "Spock," she says as the message connects. The call status indicates that he is within 1 light-year of Earth and advises to expect a small delay. "T'Pring." He does not greet her as he is legally entitled to as her betrothed. "I am calling to make amends for my behavior over the last 6.32 months. I have been entirely too emotional, and it has caused harm to the relationship we have spent a lifetime cultivating. This was illogical." "Yes, it was," T'Pring replies. "There is no one around due to the rain," and so she continues. "We can speak plainly, considering our history.
Your emotionality has been an aspect of your person that has been difficult to reconcile with your otherwise appropriate manner, as has your public infidelity with not one but two people with whom you work. You incite emotions in me that I have struggled to catalog and correctly process. Nevertheless, you remain my betrothed. And to give in to emotional language, my father will be delighted and my mother furious if we were to recommit ourselves to one another. She pauses, looking at the rain coming down on this illogical planet and letting herself process some of her equally illogical feelings as they present themselves orderly for her to consider. A quick cost-benefit analysis of the situation provides an answer, even if she files the memory of Christine's flushed cheeks away for later. I accept the overture. Prepare to make serious recompense, starting now. You will take leave and meet me on Earth. I understand. I will be able to arrive in 12 hours. This is acceptable. I will communicate my expectations and address. Thank you, to Pring. Live long and prosper. Peace and long life. Ashayam, to Pring says, and ends the call. It has finally stopped raining, and so to Pring takes herself to the transporter point and lets herself be carried back to her normal life. But no matter how much she applies logic, there is a knot in her stomach that she cannot clear. Once on the transport, she unpacks her computer and begins writing. The end.